Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. This is obviously a really great time to be having this particular conference and workshop. I mean, I think that is what all of us are doing, is anticipating physics at the LHC. And the question is, how do we go about anticipating this physics? And one we just heard and has to do with looking for various phenomenological signatures. And actually, I'm doing work in this direction too, and actually I'll come back to that later on in a completely different context. But also, the question is, what kind of models should we be looking for? What kind of things should we be thinking about? And also, there's a broader question of, do these models really make sense in sort of the larger picture? We tend to write models where we focus on one particular problem that we're trying to solve, the hierarchy problem, of course, being very notable. But the question is, what about everything else we know? Is there any way to put that together? And in particular, what about flavor physics? And I have to say, I mean, flavor physics, I think for all of us who've worked on electroweak physics, it's sort of the bugbear. We sort of just have this big set of parameters, and it's really hard to make sense of it. And it's such a complicated set of parameters that we end up, when we try to explain it, we usually end up with complicated models to try to explain them with various sets of charges or have symmetries that get broken. And basically, at the end of the day, we can get things to work, but I don't think anyone actually believes any of it. And so the question is, is this something we're never going to understand? Is it just random? Or can we get some insights into this? And of course, if it's true, it will be connected with electroweak physics. After all, we all know that the physics of flavor is connected to the physics of electroweak symmetry breaking. And so the question is, can we put it all together? And I should say that I'm going to talk about work that I did with a student, Liam Fitzpatrick, with Gilad Perez, and two projects, and we're going to focus on the quark model that I worked with them and lepton model that I did with Gilad. But there's been a number of people who've done some really nice and interesting work with respect to flavor, in particular with respect to flavor in the context of warp geometry, which is what I'm going to focus on today. And Kastu Bagashi, Chaba Chaki, and a number of other people have had some very nice insights. And I think we're really beginning to develop some sort of picture where things seem to fit together, where we can have surprisingly a low Kaluza-Klein scale, a low scale for new physics, yet generate flavor without generating overly large flavor violating effects. And I really do think this is quite remarkable and maybe worth paying attention to. And to the extent that we can come up with ways of testing these models, it's extraordinarily worthwhile. Of course, all of this is premised on the physics of warp geometry, but I think in the dual picture, it gives some insights perhaps into what we'd like, even in the context of a strongly interacting theory, to get things to work. And as we're going to see, a lot of this is based on having very non-trivial wave functions, which of course in the dual picture would correspond to very non-trivial wave function renormalizations, which we would never have anticipated in the context of a strongly interacting theory. So I think we are learning quite a bit. Whether or not it turns out to describe reality, I don't know. But I think it's a very nice picture of flavor that's been emerging. And I'll try to give some flavor of it. So, and again, lots of attention has been devoted to the weak scale. I mean, that's mostly what we're doing as we anticipate the LHC. But I think flavor still remains this outstanding issue. And I think it is worth bearing in mind that really, that has been what has given the big challenges for electroweak physics. I mean, Technicolor was killed not by precession in electroweak. It was killed by the fact that you just don't get flavor physics to work. And that's what made you have to come up with a more complicated model. All the work that's being done in supersymmetry model building has to do with the fact that it's really hard to have both the electroweak sector work, the Higgs sector work, and have the flavor sector work. So we've concentrated on the weak sector, but it's really putting it together with the flavor sector that poses the enormous challenge. So it's really worth knowing, when you have a model of electroweak symmetry breaking, can you get flavor to work? And of course, even though there's really small parameters around, these are parameters that are pretty much irrelevant for the existence of life, as we know it. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about today, I'm going to talk about just very briefly, there's a lot of talks today that will elaborate a lot on some of the things I'm going to just hint at. But just RS1 and its bulk cousin, just the bulk analog of the theory that Raman and I originally wrote down. Just talk briefly about flavor, some of the stuff people have already been thinking about. But really focus on the fact that what these models are like, the general nature of these models, are that you're not putting in any small parameters, you're not putting in small mixings, yet they come out, and they come out in just the way you want them to come out. It's really quite nice. And we'll see that there's a slight problem in terms of having to raise the KK scale. I say slight. One can debate exactly how slight it is. but unless you raise the KK scale to something like 10 or 20 TeV, it looks like there are some flavor constraints that would be serious. That's what Gilad and Liam and I worked on to just show what small additional symmetry assumption you would need in order to get around those constraints. And then we're going to talk about how we now are applying this to leptons and neutrinos, and I think have actually quite a nice picture of what neutrino flavor physics might be coming from. And I think the conclusion, and we'll see if you agree at the end, is that we can understand basically all features of masses and mixings with no very small parameters. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. We can understand the quarks masses, we can understand the angles, and we can understand what differentiates neutrinos from leptons, why they're different. And we'll see how that works. And I think just get some general picture of what we would be looking for in terms of testing the leptons flavor physics sector. Okay, so I'm going to rush through this really briefly, but one has to make sure we know the context. I think it's important to recognize, of course, warp geometries give rise to different mass scales, and that's why we can solve the hierarchy problem. We can have a TeV scale because of the warp factor related to the Planck scale through an exponential. Okay, and this geometry is the geometry in which we're going to be doing all this flavor physics, and all the flavor physics will have to do with non-trivial wave functions in this warp bulk. Okay. And this is the point that I mentioned, I want to emphasize, and I think Raman and others will be talking more about this later. I'm not going to talk about it a lot. But in the original version that we wrote down, we had everything sitting on the TeV brain in order to solve the hierarchy problem. And so we want to explain why physics occurs at the TeV scale, so everything sat here. Of course, that's not really necessary. All you really need to solve the hierarchy problem, because the hierarchy problem is really only a problem about the Higgs scalar, is you only need the Higgs scalar to be sitting here. Of course, gauge bosons and fermions can be in the bulk. Now, why don't we generally have gauge bosons and fermions in the bulk? Well, if you have gauge bosons in the bulk, your coupling strengths would be diluted too much. But the nice thing about the warp geometry, of course, is that it's not a very big space. Because if you have an exponential hierarchy, you don't need an enormous hierarchy in order to get the relationship between the TeV scale and the Planck scale to be right. In fact, in units of the ADS curvature scale, it's about 35. And when you work it out, that's not so bad. That doesn't dilute your couplings too much, so it's perfectly acceptable to have your strong gauge bosons, your weak gauge bosons in the bulk, and also to have the fermions in the bulk. Okay? So that's really important. So the two things that we only need the Higgs here and the fact that it's not too big a space tell us that we can get away with having gauge bosons and fermions in the bulk. And moreover, there are some reasons to think that this might actually be what the model of the world looks like in the fact, because it allows for interesting possibilities that aren't possible in the other case. I mean, one reason that it's favored is just in terms of you look at just precision tests, it allows, by having wave functions non-trivial in the bulk, instead of having everything sitting on the IR brain, you get weaker constraints in many cases because many processes involving the light fermions, which are of course the most constrained, will be suppressed because in principle you could have suppressed wave functions there. So it gives a route to having to dealing better with some precision tests, although there's a whole story behind that, and again, I'm not talking about that, but other people probably will. And for the similar reasons, some flavor-changing bounds are safer, again, because your wave functions can be small for the light field, so the ones that are best tested will be, in principle, the least constrained. But two reasons that it's actually nice to have bulk physics is that, in addition, is that it allows for the possibility of unification. The gauge bosons are in the bulk, which means that the cutoff for the gauge bosons is not TeV. It's actually some high scale, because you have five-dimensional gauge bosons, in principle, all the way up to the Planck scale. And in anti-de Sitter space, you actually are still getting, in some sense, logarithmic running, so that you really have the possibility of unification, just logarithmic along the lines of what we've seen before. And again, people have worked out detailed models where you actually get almost precision unification with larger errors because of the CFT. Okay. And the other thing which I will focus on today, again, this is just advertisements of other work that's been done, and I think this is all very nice, but also one of the really nice aspects of having fermions in the bulk is that you have the opportunity to explain flavor. What is the origin of flavor? I just want to mention, and I think other people will focus on this much more, this is really messy, but basically the phenomenology is quite different in the case that you have bulk physics, because you don't have the nice signatures of graviton decaying to E plus E minus, and it poses enormous challenges. And that's something people have been working on, how to look for the top, anti-top, and the final state. But it could be quite interesting as well. And there can be a dark matter candidate. Again, I'll skip that for now. What I want to focus on in today's talk is extra dimensions and flavor. And the first part will be some older work about quarks, but set the context for what we've done more recently with respect to leptons. And please feel free to interrupt at any point if there's any confusion, because the talk will follow on itself. Okay. So why can we explain favor? Well, we have bulk fields with non-trivial profiles. And in particular, there is exponential dependence generally on the mass parameters, which means that getting a hierarchy for quarks and leptons is not a problem at all. In fact, if there's any problem, it's why isn't there a bigger hierarchy? And you have exponential dependence on these mass parameters. So it's not a problem at all to get ratios of masses of order 10 to the fifth. The other thing that we're going to see very shortly is that angles, mixing angles, get connected to masses in a very suggestive way in these models, because both of them are arising from the wave function of the fermions in the infrared. So the same wave functions that are determining masses are determining angles, at least in the quark sector, and that naturally connects the angles and the masses in just the way we see. Okay. So I'll tell you more about that. Okay, so just in the cartoon version, basically the idea is that the Higgs is sitting here. The Higgs has to be sitting here. It doesn't mean we don't have a bulk Higgs. We might have a bulk Higgs, but the Higgs mode that we're interested in is definitely localized in the IR. That's the reason it has of order 100 GeV or TeV scale mass. Okay, so the Higgs is sitting here. Then we have fermions in the bulk. For heavy fermions, we'd want them localized where the Higgs is. Then there would be large overlap, implying a large Yukawa coupling. For light fermions, we'd want them localized away, implying a small Yukawa coupling. And it's as simple as that. If we have wave functions that are localized here, you would expect heavier flavors. Localized there, you expect lighter flavors. And then you get exponential dependence on the bulk mass parameters that determine these wave functions that then will determine what the actual Yukawa is. Okay? So in particular, if M is the mass in the bulk, K is the ADS curvature scale, you have an equation for the zero mode that looks like that. The solution, as I said, is an exponential in terms of phi, the variable of the coordinate of the fifth dimension. And you see you have this exponential dependence. And furthermore, you see that there's sort of this bifurcation. If M over K is greater than minus a half, you find fields that are localized in the UV. If it's less than minus one half, you find them localized in the IR, that's right. And then you get a heavy quark, okay? So it's a simple fact of whether M over K is how it relates to one half or minus one half, depending on your convention, that determines whether you have a light field or a heavy field, okay? And you have natural hierarchies from small deviations in M over K, because this is an incredibly strong dependence. So you can imagine that M over K ranges from, say, 0.3 to 0.7, and that can cover the entire range of masses we've seen, okay? Of course, it's not enough just to explain masses. It's really important to also explain mixing angles. Why are the mixing angles what they are? And also, once we get these mixing angles, why isn't flavor violation bigger than it is? And we'll come back to that point. But for now, I just want you to observe the structure of the mixing matrix. There is definitely some information there. There is something to explain. This mixing matrix is kind of like the identity. It is deviations characterized by this parameter lambda of order a fifth. And you see that those deviations are biggest when the fields are most degenerate, like the first and second generation have large mixing, the first and third generation have small mixing. So this is, although the actual numbers seem quite mysterious, this whole pattern is something that really seems to have some underlying origin, that there could be something going on that explains why these masses and mixings are correlated as much as they are. And that also is very natural in this context. So what we have here is what my collaborators and others have called an anarchic Yukawa matrix. V is the Yukawa coupling for the five-dimensional fields in the five-dimensional theory. When we actually work out what quark masses are, they depend not just on V, the Yukawa, but they depend on the wave functions as well. They depend on FQ, the left-handed wave function matrix, and FU, the right-handed wave function matrix. So when we work out masses, it's not the real Yukawa that's relevant for the four-dimensional fields, it's the product of FQ, V, and FU. So if you work out now what the Yukawa looks like, even though V has all its entries of the same order, the Yukawa matrix Y does not. And if you work out what the mixing angles are, you see that they're naturally the ratio of the left-handed wave functions. So the mixing between the ith generation and the jth generation is naturally FQI over FQJ, which, roughly speaking, you would expect to scale like the square root of the mass if you expect that these Fs are responsible for the Yukawa couplings. And of course, you have some variation with respect to how much you get from the left and the right, but you see that this correlation between the mixings and the masses is not a surprise from this point of view. Both are being determined by the wave function, okay? Which is quite nice. The angles are aligning with the mass structure. And you can interpret this in a CFT way. I think people will talk about this later. I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but I just want to say that the interpretation of what's going on here, this wave function, has to do, in some sense, with the mixing you would have between a fundamental and a composite field, which is what's relevant for the Yukawa coupling in the IR. And I'm not going to go into details here, but if you want to ask about it later, you can. And I think people will talk about it later today. Okay, so I hope you believe that we can easily get masses and mixings from this setup. And again, we're not putting in any weird tuning of parameters. It's just some random numbers, really centered around 0.5, and it just naturally gives rise to what we thought was a completely bizarre pattern of masses and mixings. I mean, I can't tell you precisely why they are the ones that they are, but I think that's a lot for us to explain. I think what we want to explain is why is there this mass hierarchy and why these angles are correlated in the way they are. But what about flavor violation? Well, of course, it seems extremely dangerous from the point of view of flavor violation. And if we can get away with flavor, I think there's something really going on. And why does it seem dangerous? Well, what do we have? We have entire functions that violate flavor. We don't have anything like a gym mechanism naively, because what we have are entire functions depending on the bulk masses, not just the mass parameters of the Yukawas themselves. Furthermore, the Vs that we put in have large mixing angles, right? So there's, in principle, no flavor structure from the start. Remember, we had order one mixings in the five-dimensional Yukawa. And finally, we'd like at least to have TEV scale Kaluza-Klein modes, which means that new physics could, in principle, be coming in at quite a low scale, which seems very dangerous from the point of view of flavor. However, it's really incredible. Flavor physics is much better, in some sense, than we have a right to expect. Lots of protection is automatic. It's not quite enough, and that's what led to some of the future work that we did, but I think it is worth noting that even without doing anything else, I mean, this is just following your nose, essentially, putting in no special structure. You still do quite well with respect to flavor physics. Okay. So, for example, the things you have to worry about are Kaluza-Klein exchange, say, of a gluon, which could give rise to KK bar mixing. And as I said here, we have different profiles for different generations. So let me say why you do somewhat better than you might have thought you would. And there's basically two reasons. One is what I mentioned at the very beginning, the simple fact that the wave functions for the light fields are small, right? If the wave functions of the light fields are small in the IR, that's where you get the TEV scale Kaluza-Klein modes. They are peaked here. So what you are concerned with when you're looking at flavor physics mediated by TEV scale Kaluza-Klein modes is how big the wave functions are here in the IR. And they're small. I mean, that's the assumption. That's why you get small Yukawa. So automatically, these flavor changing effects are suppressed by masses or the square root of masses because they're suppressed by the wave functions. Okay, so the IR contribution to these flavor phase effects is, of course, small. Okay. The other thing, and here's actually a place where it really matters that it's the warp geometry, is that the KK gluons are flat in the UV. You might think, well, okay, the wave functions are small here, but there is a tail of this KK gluons that goes all the way out into the UV. The wave functions for the light modes are localized in the UV. So there could, in principle, be flavor-changing effects here if these KK gluons had some non-trivial spatial structure in the UV region. The thing is, that's not true. It turns out, if you work out, this is not true for the KK graviton, for example, but if you work out a KK gluon mode, looks like, it actually goes down very quickly, roughly exponentially, but then it's flat in the UV. Okay, that's just what it looks like. And you can understand that from the point of view of vector meson dominance. And again, I think people will talk about this later, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But basically what's going on is you're mixing with the flat mode. So if you look at the shape of the gluon mode in the UV for the Kaluza-Klein mode, you find it's flat. And because it's flat, again, that kills flavor-changing effects, just like it does for the gluon zero mode. It's only when you have a non-trivial profile of the KK gluon in the region that these wave functions are peaked that you would get these flavor-changing effects. Okay. So what you're left with in basic, and I think this is perhaps a general lesson that might be of interest, particularly for the LHC, is that it's very hard to get minimal flavor violation, but it is not, but these models naturally give rise to what's been called next to minimal flavor violation, where you have flavor violation that arises because of mixing with the top. And this is the fact that the top is localized in the IR. The top does overlap quite strongly with the KK modes. So to the extent that your light fermions mix with the third generation, you will get flavor changing effects. And that is the dominant flavor source of flavor violation in these models. So one of the problems is KK bar mixing, which puts quite a strong constraint, which people worked out in more detail here. And the other problem is what I've started to call the little CP problem, which is just the fact that even if you have an axion model, in any model that really has new physics at the electroweak scale, you generally have one loop contributions that are too big to the neutron electric dipole moment, which generally forces you to tune something, a phase or something, at the level of 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 3. It's true in supersymmetry, and it's true in these models as well. And so you can interpret it, again, as raising the Suzy scale or raising the KK scale, or perhaps something else is going on. Okay, so what we asked was, how can you lower the scale? And so what Gilad and Liam and I did is we just introduced a sort of gym-like mechanism. And it's not nearly as strong as an actual gym mechanism, but is a gym-like mechanism that suppresses this extra, that gives us enough suppression that we can bring the KK scale hopefully down to a few TeV again. Okay. I'm going to explain what it is in a minute. Okay. And what I'm going to tell you in the rest of the talk is, first of all, it will let us lower the KK scale, and furthermore, it's going to give us a very nice picture for neutrinos. Okay, so what do I mean by this sort of pseudo-gym mechanism? We haven't actually finalized our name. But what's the generic case? Well, why do we have so much flavor violation? Well, we have a lot of flavor violating parameters. In addition to the two Yukawas, and these should be what I called these Vs earlier. These are the five-dimensional Yukawas. These were just two random matrices that we had in the bulk. We have the bulk masses, and again, I changed notation, so that's C is the bulk masses now. And we have three bulk masses. We have one for the right-handed up fields, one for the right-handed down fields, and one for the left-handed fields. So that's five matrices of flavor violating parameters, and clearly that's too much. I mean, that's what we've learned, so it's a little bit too much. So what we assume, and one can work out a model where this is true, and that's other people are doing that, Chaba and Gilad and collaborators, is say that suppose this wasn't true. Suppose there really were only two flavor violating matrices. That is to say, there are SU3 symmetries for the left-handed quarks, the right-handed quarks, up type quarks, the right-handed down type quarks, broken only by Yukawas. Where those Yukawas come from is a model-dependent question, but let's just look phenomenologically and see whether this works. And it isn't a big assumption because you do have to make sure that you can fit everything. We do have all these masses and mixings, and we now have many fewer parameters. But the Cs, of course, in this case, will be functions of the Ys, and the question is determined solely by the flavor symmetry and fitting. And so the question is, can you fit things, and how does this help you with flavor? Okay. So it's a gym-like mechanism in the sense that the five-dimensional Yukawas are the only flavor-violating parameters, but it's a much weaker than our standard gym, because the standard gym says it's all proportional to quark mass and mixing, and here it's some complicated function of these Vs, all of whose entries are ordered one. Okay, so we're not going to get nearly as much flavor violation, but we will get enough. Okay. So what this assumption means, in particular, there are non-trivial coefficients in front of all these things, is that these Cs are a linear combination of the identity, which of course respects the SU3 symmetries we've assumed, and a flavor violation that is consistent with the flavor symmetry, consistent with the way the Yukawas break the flavor symmetry. So here it's Y dagger Y, and here it's Y Y dagger. And the thing to notice is that as far as C U D goes, these bulk masses are of course diagonalized. If everything had worked like this, suppose CQ was just the identity, then the bulk masses would be diagonalized at the same time the Yukawa is diagonalized, and that's why we're getting some extra suppression. We simultaneously diagonalize these bulk masses at the same time we diagonalize the Yukawas. Now, let's think about the down sector for a moment. Suppose R were zero, then as far as the down quarks go, you would diagonalize the entire mass matrix at the same time you diagonalize the Yukawa. So what happens is this flavor violation now in principle, has this extra parameter R involved. And to the extent that R is a small parameter, you get extra flavor suppression in the down sector. Of course, that wouldn't be true for the up sector, and we do, in fact, predict interesting flavor-changing effects in the up sector, in particular top flavor-changing decays, which is, could be quite interesting at the LHC. Okay. So as I said, we still get the same, it turns out you can fit the masses in mix, and you still get the same dependence for masses, dependence for angles, and you can get everything to work. But in the R0 limit, you have no flavor violation in the down sector, which is enough to suppress things quite a lot, of course, if R is small. And as I said earlier, we do predict interesting flavor changing effects in the top sector. So the value of R is something that you actually have to determine by fitting. There's a range of possible values of R, but it turns out you can find that many examples where R is small, and that's enough to suppress flavor enough. No, they don't have to be one. That's why I said this was just quality. Yeah, and in particular, absolutely. And really what matters at the end of the day is the ratio of the down Yukawa piece to the up Yukawa piece. That's what really determines how badly misaligned the masses and the Yukawa would be. Yeah. Okay. So this is just the point that it also helps with a strong CP because it tells you that the CP violation occurs only at two loops. Essentially, here again, we have the same property as the Sanamal that there's only a single phase. And when there's only a single phase, CP violation is killed at one loop, and you can work it out explicitly and see that the one loop contribution. At the time we wrote a paper, we thought it was around 15 TeV. Chaba and company have somewhat stronger constraints, so they think it might be around 20 TeV. So we're not lowering it an enormous amount. But from the point of view of the LHC, it's an enormous amount because you've gone from unreachable to possibly reachable. And plus, it's better from naturalness. And so what are signatures of these models? Well, you have the generic signatures you have for bulk models. In particular, I think most people agree that the KK gluon could be the most interesting thing to look for in these bulk scenarios, although that gives you a lot of challenges. Maybe KK graviton, KKZ, there's other things. Top flavor changing effects are really important. And of course, we have small down-type flavor violation, but in the up sector, you get a lot. So you might have DD bar CP violation about 10%. So there are some very interesting flavor predictions in these models. And I should have said in the beginning, I think in the last year or so, I think this connection between flavor physics and electroweak physics has really been revitalized. I think there's been just a lot of interesting work, both in theory and in experiment. And I think those are both going to continue for another year or two until LHC really starts pumping things out. The one other thing I want to point out, because it's also kind of relevant for the leptons, is that you can view this as a good or a bad thing, but I think it is quite interesting if you look at what, so these Cs are the bulk mass eigenvalues, and what you see is that they're all kind of centered around 0.5, right? They're 0.5, 0.6, you might say 0.6. But they're not really very unnaturally tuned if you just said they were random parameters, but it's suggestive that the flavor symmetry looks like it's more or less preserved. The Cs are somewhat degenerate, and then it's broken by small parameters, which is consistent with the kind of structure we've set up. We have SU3, and then SU3 is broken by YY dagger, or Y dagger Y. Okay? And I think that is quite nice. Okay. And if you ask the question, why is the hierarchy not bigger, it's just the fact that this coefficient isn't enormous, that this symmetry breaking has some small parameter, maybe of order of fifth in front of it. Okay? What we're going to see next, when we talk about leptons, is the difference between quark and leptons, in some sense, will have to do with the size of this coefficient. Because this coefficient being of order of fifth is enough to give us the entire bizarre spectrum of quark masses. If this coefficient is of order of percent, then we're going to find order one mixing angles and also much smaller hierarchy. Okay, so we'll talk about that now. Okay. So before we turn to lipton sector, just a summary of the quark sector. We have natural explanation for masses and mixings. We can have a low scale and an interesting flavor. And in my remaining 5 minutes, I'll tell you the entire talk on leptons. Okay. All right. So what about neutrinos? So let's just look at the neutrino parameters, because they really don't look like quark parameters. And you know, if you have a good model of flavor, one thing you'd like of it is not just to explain why angles are correlated with masses, but you'd like to know, why are quarks and leptons different? If you could explain that, maybe there's something going on. Because there's something really, there are enough qualitative features that distinguish the two that even with, again, without being able to predict each thing quite precisely, you still seem to get a lot of information. So what are the obvious things that are different? Well, one is, of course, thank you. Go away, please. Okay, I thought I turned that off. Okay, one is that you have large mixing angles. And the other is an interesting fact that I sort of didn't really appreciate until I started working on this, which is that neutrinos really are a lot more degenerate than the quarks. Okay, we don't know the mass of the lightest neutrino, but if you look at the ratio of neutrino masses, it's about a factor, it could be consistent with about a factor of 5 between the two. There's not a huge neutrino hierarchy, which is kind of interesting, and the mixing angles are order 1. And those are things you'd like to explain. Okay? So the and of course there's the other fact, which of course everyone knows, which is that neutrino masses are just small. Okay, so they're small, there's big mixing angles, and they're somewhat degenerate. Okay, what's the typical explanation for smallness is seesaw mechanism, and in fact that is what we're going to have as well. And typical parameters that work are sort of having a neutrino Yukawa of order 0.1, and the right-handed neutrino mass of order 10 to 12 GeV, and we're going to get that as well. And the other distinctive feature is in fact big mixing, which we just went over. Okay, so what do big angles imply in this scenario? Well, there's a number of ways you might think of getting big angles, but the most obvious one, at least it seems to me, is that you really keep your anarchic structure. Remember, we started off with anarchic Yukawas, right? The Yukawas you put in don't have any special structure. The only special structure we got was a result of the left-handed wave functions being non-trivial. That is to say, they were helping explain masses. If the left-handed wave functions are in fact degenerate, then you just have the order 1 mixing angles that you started out with. I mean, it's pretty clear, okay? So we'd like to have the C sub L's for the neutrino sector be degenerate. And one question we asked was how degenerate they'd have to be. And I'm just going to anticipate, because we are running low on time, that the degree of degeneracy is roughly speaking 1 over the volume, because that exponential dependence we have has to do with the volume times this mass parameter. And so if you have the mass, the degeneracy, within 1 over the volume, you basically get all the wave functions being essentially the same, which is enough to give you order 1 mixing angles. So whereas the parameter before, that epsilon parameter is about a fifth, if you had that parameter being about 0.01, or y's being smaller, you would naturally get CL's being degenerate enough, FL's being degenerate, and order 1 mixing angles. So it's something that comes out as a result of some small parameter difference between a tenth and a hundredth. Naturally tells you, in one case, you get small mixing angles aligned with masses just the way we have in the quark sector. In another case, you get order 1 mixing angles just the way we have in the neutrino sector. So I think that's really quite beautiful. Okay, and that's what this slide says. Okay, this epsilon parameter is related to this ratio, and you see that you have an exponential, and as long as you have this degeneracy within about 0.01, you have angles order 1 due to the degeneracy of the wave function. So how do we implement this in a model? Well, it's quite straightforward. We did, as we said, want to implement a seesaw mechanism for reasons that I'll come back to in a moment. But we have the Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrino N on the UV. We have, on the IR, we have a Yukawa with order 1 mixing. And we have just the bulk mass parameters, okay? Or bulk mass matrices. Charged lepton masses are, in fact, the product of FL, YE, and FE. Right, the light neutrino masses are arising from a seesaw mechanism, so they involve FL twice, Ys twice, and FNs twice. And this is the right-handed neutrino mass. Okay, so we want to get the right-handed neutrino mass not to be M Planck, but to be about 10 to the 12th GeV. So that's going to follow from having the wave function for the right-handed neutrino peak somewhat on the IR, so that we have a small wave function of UV, and so we can naturally get 10 to the 12th GeV. Okay. The reason we did a seesaw mechanism was because we didn't see any other reason to disallow this operator that you'd naturally have on the IR, unless you have some left-hand number that's preserved. So you can naturally write down the dimension 5 operator from the four-dimensional point of view, psi left h dagger h psi over m, which would give rise to much too big a neutrino mass because m is of order TeV in the IR. So we had to forbid that, which meant we had to impose lepton number, which meant we had to gauge lepton number. And so we have a lepton number symmetry that's broken in the UV to keep it far away from the IR. Okay? So that's why we felt that you really do need a seesaw mechanism, even though you could have, in principle, if you didn't worry about this, if you just said this operator isn't there, you could just say that there are small wave functions, as other people have done. But in order to naturally forbid that operator, we wanted to have lepton number symmetry. Okay. Okay. So what does this have to do with the first part of the talk? Well, of course, the entire structure is the same. But in addition, we needed to have a similar assumption for that there were only these two flavor violating parameters. We didn't want to take independent bulk mass parameters. And here you really needed the gauge lepton flavor symmetry, because otherwise you would have large, enormous tree level flavor changing effects. Because you could have left switch into right, which then, and these are order one mixings through the Yukawas, so you would have enormous flavor changing effects in the Z in general. So this LMFE assumption where we have where we assume the bulk masses are functions solely of the Yukawas tell us that we can simultaneously diagonalize the bulk masses and the Yukawas and be okay. And again, the bonus of this assumption is the one that I've emphasized a couple of times now, is it naturally explains the difference between quarks and leptons. We start off with SU3 symmetry, we break it through the Yukawas, and you can only have small breaking in the case of the neutrinos, so that you have naturally order one mixing angles. Okay. So I'm really short on time, so I'm just going to outline what we did. You basically have to, so we have several constraints. It's not a giveaway. You have to make sure that you're okay with precision electro weak, which means the wave functions can't be too big on the IR for the charged leptons. That's a constraint. You have to make sure that you get the Majorana masses adjusted correctly. And you have to make sure the flavor changing is adequately suppressed. And you put all these things together, and you find a set of parameters that work. This isn't that insightful right now, but I do want you to notice that the Yukawa for the neutrinos are somewhat smaller. And I think that's a very interesting fact that's going to be true of a lot of models. So I'm going to, I think, since I don't have a lot of time, I do want to spend a few minutes just looking at that particular one. And feel free to ask anything else. This has to do with the constraints on the IR wave functions, constraints from precision Z measurements, possible constraint from mixing with singlets. But what I said is I want to focus on this lepton flavor violation constraint, because I think that's interesting, and I think there's something quite general to be learned here. Okay, so where are we? We have a model where we're explaining the neutrino masses. We have two independent parameters. We have Y electron, the electron Yukawa, and Y neutrino, the neutrino Yukawa, and those are the only parameters. And we have this what we called LMFE assumption, lepton minimal flavor violation, which tells us those are the only two flavor violating parameters in the theory, or matrices. We still, of course, get flavor violation the same way in the standard model you still get flavor violation. Because you at the one loop level, the charged leptons feed into the neutrinos and vice versa. The neutrino Yukawa feeds into the charged leptons. And those are not assumed to be aligned. YN and YE are completely independent matrices. So at one loop level, you will get flavor violating effects that depend on YN that are not aligned with the electron masses and therefore would generate flavor violation. Okay? And so here's an example. It's probably the most stringent example where you which will be the constraint from U to E gamma. Okay? So we have two Yukawa vertices. Okay? So we have YN, we have YN dagger, and YE. Okay? These are KK modes being exchanged. There's a charge, Higgs, and a photon. Okay. So what is the structure that emerges? Well, we have something that involves YN, YN dagger, YE, FE. Okay. So there's going to be some constraint. This is a one-loop effect. FE is somewhat suppressed, but that's about it. So we have one-loop suppression and FE suppression. And then the question is, what is mu to E gamma? Okay. And it's actually a little bit tricky to work this out, okay? Because in the case of a brain Higgs, it's actually a divergent contribution. And then you have to work out what you expect from counter terms of the higher dimensional operators. You can do that, and it's an interesting story. I'm short on time, but ask me about it in the questions. But you basically relate the cutoff of your theory to the Yukawas in such a way that you see at the end of the day, you get a constraint on precisely that combination we talked about earlier, YN dagger. You get a constraint on that, and that basically puts you in a situation, if you take this higher dimension estimate seriously, of about 0.1 for a 3 TeV KK mass. Okay? So basically, if the KK modes are as low as 3 TeV, the Yukawa overall scale for the Yukawa can't be 1. It has to be about 0.1. And the thing I'd like to emphasize is that this is not just a feature of our model, okay? We'd like to say this is a way of distinguishing our model, but actually it's quite general that in any model where you have TeV scale physics and you have large mixing angles for the Yukawas, because here remember, the mixing angles are order one from the four-dimensional and the five-dimensional point of view. So even if you're doing a model that doesn't have this anarchic five-dimensional Yukawa, you still have large mixings in the four-dimensional case. And for that reason, you get constraints like Jim and Morrissey worked out. For example, even a supersymmetric model, that y is generally can't be maximal, which puts a constraint on the right-handed neutrino mass. This is combination y squared over mr that's constrained. That's the mass, and then there's y, which is constrained simply by these flavor changing effects. And it forces you to take it about 0.1. The other interesting thing about this being the dominant contribution is that you're naturally getting a relationship between tau flavor changing effects and mu flavor changing effects. Because the Yukawa coupling for the mu and the Yukawa coupling from the tau are generally not going to be separated by more than the square root of the ratio of the masses of the third and the second neutrino, which says that the ratio between the two is generally, if this is the dominant contribution, will never be bigger than a factor of about 60, okay? Which I think is quite a general statement. Okay. So this is what I just said. And this is what I've said several times. But here we see that small y is at least consistent with the fact that we want smaller flavor breaking in the lepton sector. Okay. So to summarize, the model's pretty simple. There's two Yukawas, degenerate bulk masses for the Ls, maybe some small breaking, lepton number breaking in the UV, and we get everything we want. Small neutrino masses, order one mixing angles, and suppressed flavor violation. And it explains the difference between neutrinos and quarks. So. Predictions? Probably mu to E gamma is always going to be the strongest constraint. It's not necessarily at the limit, it's a question of what Y is. But as I said a moment ago, you can relate tau to mu gamma to mu to E gamma. So this model would definitely be ruled out if anyone measured tau to mu gamma in the near future, because we never predict that big a ratio between tau to mu gamma and mu to E gamma. Okay, so it's easier to rule out than to discover, unfortunately, but you can rule it out. That's what I said a moment ago. I think there are also important soft predictions of this kind of model, and I think this will distinguish our model from the kind of model that Chaba might be talking about. But what we say is just that the mixing angles are big. We don't say the mixing angles are 1 over root 3, 1 over root 2. We just say they're big order 1 numbers. If people went out and measured these things at, I don't know what level of precision, it's again a soft prediction, but if they measured it and found exactly 1 over root 3, exactly 1 over root 2, or if you find that S13 is really, really like 0 or very small, this model will be ruled out. We're assuming that this is just some random matrix consistent with what Hitoshi said, that you S13 doesn't really have to be 0. It could be sort of, it doesn't have to be order 1. It doesn't have to be that big. That you find a lot of matrices where S13 is a little bit smaller than the rest of them, but it's basically generic order 1 entries. So that's consistent with our model. If that's not true, then this would not be right. So this is just saying that, yes, neutrinos are different, but it's just that the mixing angles are big, not that they take particular values. So to conclude, I think I've said most of this, so I'll just run through it quickly. We have, I hope what you think is a concise picture of flavor. It's simply broken by anarchic Yukawas. There's no flavor structure ever assumed in the Yukawas. Also, the bulk masses are a function of these Yukawas, so that we have SU3 symmetry broken only by these Yukawas. The wave functions are enough to explain masses and mixing, and furthermore, the structure explains the differences between quarks and leptons. Flavor suppression is adequate with order 0.1 tuning. We have sort of a Jim mechanism, and the KK scales can be low. And I do think this, I don't know if it's right, but I do think it's quite amazing. I mean, the flavor structure just seemed completely mysterious. I mean, this is something people have been thinking about for years, and there just never is a case where you just find it all working out kind of nicely with only a few parameters. Here, there really are no strange parameters being put in, but you're able to explain the entire flavor structure. So we maybe have some hope of understanding the plethora of parameters in the standard model. Thank you.
Questions? Okay, Gordy and then Chaba.
You emphasized that the quarks had no flavor symmetry and the leptons do have a flavor symmetry, so you're treating them really fundamentally differently.
No. If I said that, that's not what I said. Or not what I meant to say. There's flavor symmetry in both sectors. In both cases, we assume SU3. In fact, there's some gauge symmetry because ADS-CFT tells us. It's broken only by Yukawas. The difference between leptons and quarks is how much breaking by Yukawas. So in one case, you have 0.01 as a parameter point. In the other case, you have 0.1 as a parameter. But that's the difference. That's it.
Did you have for one of the C parameters 0.44 on the slide?
Yeah, that was a typo. It should have been 0.48.
I'm sorry? Because if it's less 0.5, then you'll get in trouble with the electrical
precision.
Yeah, it was
0.48. You're right. It was a typo.
But 0.48 is already also probably a problem. Anything below 0.5 is
no,
for the tau coupling to the Z would be a problem, I think.
We worked this out pretty carefully, so we can talk about it. We were consistent with all the constraints, so we can talk about that. Yeah, I mean, in fact, that's basically the limit. This was at the limit. I mean, we have a whole range of parameters that are consistent.
Who ordered the right-handed neutrino?
Who ordered? Why shouldn't
because
there be a right-handed neutrino?
Well, why should there be? I mean, it's a fairly strong hypothesis in the scheme, and it doesn't seem to be related to anything else. So do you have any hint where it's connected?
I mean, look, our attitude is basically, you know, it's complicated enough. What is the data telling us? We have an enormous amount of data. We have masses and mixing, a huge number of unexplained numbers. The fact is, if we don't put in the right-handed neutrino, we cannot explain the mass. If you don't have this gauge lepton number symmetry, you naturally just get neutrino masses that are way off. You can fit it without having the right-handed neutrino. It's just then you don't explain why you don't have this operator. So if there's some other way to eliminate the operator, we wouldn't need the right-handed neutrino.
Just that I would be tempted to put the right-handed neutrino. I would be tempted to
make
it away by some
age. I didn't say this, but there's no reason this scenario can't be consistent with unification. In fact, it's probably more, this is maybe overstating, but naively it seems like a much better starting point because you start off with flavor symmetry broken only by these small bulk masses. Whereas in standard unification, it's a real problem to explain why masses are so different. Yes, you get B-tau unification, but nothing else works naturally. So, I mean, in fact, this might be a better starting point if you want to get a unified model.
There's something about the way you present this that confuses me. So I don't know if you can go back to the point where you said that there are five matrices, the bulk matrices, and the Yukawas was in the first half of the talk.
Okay.
Maybe while I'm asking the question.
Yeah.
So the point is that the argument was that you have the anarchical Yukawas, and then you have a certain structure in the bulk mass matrices, and then mm-hmm. you get the small flavor change. The point is, when we switch off the Yukawas, we can diagonalize these C matrices by standard field redefinition. So,
Cs are general, even when the Cs are general, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the thing. You never have five matrices. So, I mean, we can go to a basis where the Cs are diagonal. So we have 9 C parameters.
I mean, what's really relevant is the fact that the Ys and the Cs are not simultaneously.
That's the thing. What I'm saying is, before we switch on the Yukawas, it's a very natural basis to have the C's diagonal and just have these 9 species of decoupled
fermions.
Yeah,
but you have no mixings in that basis either, so
that's true. But the point is, what you're doing for the C's in this basis just corresponds to choosing almost diagonal hook Yukawas. So basically, the argument that you have anarchical structure in the Yukawas is really not true in this model, because if you go to the natural basis, your Yukawas are finely tuned.
Okay,
they're almost diagonal matrices.
Right, so, I mean, what you're saying is, I mean, it's true, see, what we're saying is it's the identity plus some random matrix.
Yeah, that's a flavor symmetry, that goes beyond, but the fact that, not just a unit matrix.
Right.
They have a hierarchical structure.
Right, but the point is that what you're adding onto it is some epsilon parameter in general, times some completely random matrix. That's our assumption, right? Now, the fact that epsilon is small is saying that this SU3 symmetry is
broken. I'm saying something different. I'm saying in the basis where the Cs are diagonal, also in your model, when you diagonalize the Cs, you will find that you have very hierarchical Yukawa matrices. So I'm just saying that in this particular model, I would not say that you get the flavor structure from anarchy. The five-dimensional Yukawas.
No, that's not true.
Yes.
I mean, we can go. I mean, I can show you what the Yukawas are. They're not that hierarchical.
In the basis where the Cs are diagonalized, you will have very hierarchical Yukawas, and that's why the flavor constraints work out the way they work out.
Okay. Let's talk about that later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments?
Okay.
Okay. Is there a second microphone hanging around? Yeah. Raise your hand if there's a second one. Oh, it's in his backpack.
If you give up on wanting to make the KK states low, so you allow them to be up at 10 to 20 TeV, do I understand correctly? Then you don't need all these flavor symmetries, etc. You can have nice geometrical origin for all the fermion mass and mixing hierarchies at the price of some fine-tuning of the electroweak scale?
Yeah, so basically...
So what's the price? That's what I'm...
Yeah, it's basically that you would just have a high KK scale. So to the extent that you want... Because everything works. I mean, that was sort of the point of the first part of the talk. Basically, everything works incredibly well. The only thing is there's, you know, the epsilon parameter and CP violation turn out to be somewhat wrong, so that you have to raise the KK scale just for those two particular processes to make flavor-changing constraints okay. As far as just explaining flavor and angles, it worked just fine.
So what is the price you actually pay for raising the KK scale?
You will never know if it's right, but that's not our... I mean, it's true, whatever it is, you know.
But in terms of tuning for the weak scale?
How
much tuning? I'm just curious.
I never understand how to calculate how much tuning. I mean, you want to have 100 GV Higgs and you have a 20 TV, you have more than a 20 TV cutoff. So
it's just that it seems that the flavor sector is so much prettier when you give up on the low KK scale. That's what I'm just, it's a trade-off.
I didn't go through a model, but I actually don't think it's necessarily ugly what we have here. I mean, it's just, in fact, in some ways, it's kind of nicer. I mean, we're just saying that there's SU3 symmetry. I mean, it is actually what the model seems to be telling us. There are sort of SU3 symmetries, and they're broken just by mu collids. I mean, so the question is just, are they broken by two matrices, or are they broken by five matrices? And I don't necessarily think it's any more or less likely one or the other. But, you know, that's a really model-dependent question.
Okay, we'll need to go to the break now. Let's thank Lisa again.
Can you announce about lunch?
Oh, you want to announce it?
Yeah, when did you do it? When you come back?
Yeah, when we come back, I'll check out the room.
See it, yeah. Okay, cool.